National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns, is brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check out their website at cybersecuritysummit.org for a list of their upcoming webinar series. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, and you've joined us for this edition of National Security This Week. We get together every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're fortunate enough to be joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us learn more about national security challenges and opportunities. We have a truly fantastic show for you today. Listeners to this show have heard me talk about the struggle between the liberal democracies of the world and the rising autocracies. That struggle was sort of below the tabletop for the past decade, but after Russia invaded Ukraine, it has taken center stage. The winner of that struggle will write the rules for the new global order. But there's a second struggle taking place, one that's not so obviously visible in the liberal democracies around the world. A struggle we sense is happening in democratic nations around the world, but it's been difficult to define. We'll define that challenge today and learn how it's undermining liberal democracies around the world. Our guest today is Dr. Moises Naim. Moises Naim is a distinguished fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also an internationally syndicated columnist and the host and producer of Efecto Naim, a weekly television program on international affairs that airs throughout the Americas and won an Emmy in 2018. In the early 1990s, Moises Naim served as Venezuela's Minister of Development, director of its central bank, and as an executive director at the World Bank. From 1996 to 2010, he was editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine. Naim is also the author of many scholarly articles and over 15 books on international affairs, economics, and politics, including the book Illicit and the book The End of Power, which were selected by the Washington Post and the Financial Times as best books of the year. He recently published his best-selling sequel to The End of Power. The new book is The Revenge of Power, which The New Yorker highlighted as one of the best books of 2022. Dr. Moises Naim has a PhD from MIT and lives in Washington, D.C. with his family. Dr. Moises Naim, welcome to National Security This Week.
Hi, John. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You and I were just talking before we got on the air. You mentioned something else about The Revenge of Power being named best book. Who was it that named it the best book of 2022?
The New Yorker magazine.
Oh, so it was The New Yorker. Okay.
Yeah.
So you and I are on Zoom. I'm sitting in the beautiful studios here of KYMN Radio in downtown Northfield, Minnesota. Where are you this morning?
I am in my office in Washington, D.C.
All right. At the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your current work at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace? What are you researching at Carnegie? What do they do at Carnegie?
Well, Carnegie does a lot of things. Almost all the major challenges facing humanity are, you have a group of people that are very well informed and rigorous thinkers trying to sort out the major dilemmas of our time. And, you know, Carnegie has one of the world's strongest programs on democracy, on nuclear policy, what to do with nukes and how. Sustainability and climate and geopolitics, the intersection of these three things. The global order, how to organize ourselves in this 21st century full of challenges and unexpected reality. And I work on the intersection of politics and economics at the global level.
And you also served as editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine for, 15 years? Which means you reviewed and published thoughtful, well-researched, in-depth articles penned by scholars and political leaders from around the world. Foreign Policy tackles some of the hardest challenges humanity faces with each issue, and frankly, from my perspective, it's a fantastic magazine. I've been a subscriber for many, many years. How did that experience as editor-in-chief help you to frame your thinking about the challenges to the liberal democratic order around the world today?
It's probably one of the most important experiences I have had in my life. As you mentioned, I do have a PhD from MIT, but that's nothing compared to what I learned editing foreign policy, which, as you said, every day I would get pitches and proposals and suggestions from writers and scholars and media leaders. And so I got an education. And as a result of that, I am obsessed with trying to understand what's going on, what are the surprises. The surprises of globalization has always been a theme of mine. What is this new trend and new reality that connects countries, even if they are oceans apart, and then they face the, you know, the notion, it's an old idea, is that we're all the neighbors here. What happens there matters here, and vice versa. So we are connected, and that is creating all kinds of challenges for institutions that were not designed for that kind of global integration, and creates new, as I said, surprises. The surprises of globalization is a theme that is quite important.
And during your time as editor-in-chief at Foreign Policy from 96 to 2010, what kind of trends did you see kind of in the international order? From what you can remember. I mean, I know that's a long period of time, and it was 12 years ago that you left the editor-in-chief position. But a lot of the things that we're dealing with today, those trends started back in that time frame.
So as I said, my vision for the magazine was to educate myself and educate the readers about what are the new things that are happening that are have no precedent and are related to globalization. And as a result of that, of going around, I traveled quite a bit. I traveled all the time, and wherever I went, I was with my eyes open to the surprises of globalization. And I discovered that the group, everybody was going global. Mm. Governments and churches and companies and non-governmental organizations and hobbyists and terrorists. But the group that really was taking advantage of the fast first mover were international criminal cartels. Mm. Criminal cartels that were local or perhaps even regional, but now went global. And so you find Tanzanian traffickers operated in Thailand, and you find New York financial operations linked with Colombia, and so on. The world was becoming an oyster for these criminal cartels. As a result of that, I decided to write a book titled Illicit, in which I looked at five of the main areas in which this was happening. As a result of that, I renewed my interest in government and other in studying what government is. And I was surprised by how weak governments were, how constrained. And then from that came the end of power, that essentially argues that in these days, power has become easier to acquire, harder to use, and easier to lose. Mm. And then a decade after that book comes this one, The Revenge of Power, which is a study of what are people in power doing to make sure that the forces that fragment, dilute, and weaken power don't dislodge them from power.
Mm, yeah. For our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Moises Naim, and we're discussing global challenges to democracy. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. Learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. Dr. Naim, we just mentioned it. Your recent book is titled The Revenge of Power. I read the book as I was preparing for today's show. It is a stunning read. Frankly, it's quite terrifying and extremely insightful. You've captured in this book the mechanisms for how democracies are being undermined around the world, giving rise to a new form of authoritarian leader. I have many, many things to ask you today about the book and your research, but let's start with this this first question. What specifically was the catalyst that led you to research this book and to write The Revenge of Power?
The ascent of stealthy tyrants. Mm. I discovered how now it has become almost necessary for a politician to present himself or herself as a Democrat. But in fact, once in government, they continue to pretend that they are Democrats, but in fact, their actions and their behaviors and their policies and their politics are designed to undermine the checks and balances of a democracy. and do away with term limits and ensure that they stay in power regardless of what are the rules and the constitution and all that. And so I decided that I needed to look deeply into the forces that are concentrating power and shape them, see how they interact with the forces that dilute power that I studied in the other book titled The End of Power. So it's not that it's not an either or. It's not that power is completely diluting or power is completely concentrating. Both things are happening at the same time and intertwining interdependence and interrelations of the three of these two forces are, I think, the defining trends of our life these days.
And we have a lot that I'd like to cover, but the central theme of your book is that there's essentially a renaissance in the rise of autocracy around the world, and that the global liberal democratic order is being undermined by these democratic leaders who are using a new playbook of methods to achieve their goals, to attain power and then hang on to power. You refer to the challenge of the three P's of our modern world, and those are populism, polarization, and these post-truth narratives. And so I have two questions for you. This is probably going to get a little complex. This might take a little bit of time to get through this, but I think it's really important for our listeners. First, I'd like to ask you if you could define the term liberal democracies. A lot of people hear that and they don't maybe necessarily understand exactly what we mean by that when we talk about it in the foreign policy arena. And then could you please explain the challenge that liberal democracies face from these three forces, the three P's, populism, polarization, and these post-truth narratives? Give us a way to think about these three terms and how they're at work in liberal democracies around the world today.
Liberal democracies are about freedom. Liberal democracies are a system of government and of politics that ensures that no one concentrates power absolutely, that power is divided and there are three forces of three kinds of powers, legislative, you know, the Congress, the executive, which is the presidency, and the judicial, the Supreme Court and all our judicial system. All three coexist. All three are designed to check the power of the other, and together, working in synchronicity, they are in a synchronous way. They define what a democracy is, where no one, no group, no individual, no political party concentrates power. So. And the three P's are the three strategies that would be leaders or actual leaders are using to undermine democracy very often from within. These are governments and politicians that win an election, but as soon as they are in power, they start undermining the checks and balances and the division of powers and the checks and balances that limit and constrain what they can do. And they use for that the three P's: populism, polarization, and post-truth. Populism is very old. It's not an ideology, because we find practitioners of populism in the right and the left, in the north and the south, everywhere. Populism has become quite popular and quite common. And it's founded, it's centered, anchored in an old idea that is divide and conquer. So populists divide the nation between a noble people that is exploited by a horrible elite that exploits it. And then it requires the presence of a strong, often man, a strong man or a strong woman that represents the interests of the noble people that are exploited. That, of course, is just propaganda. And in fact, is just a trick to divide the country and have enough votes to rule in a way that, as I said before, often undermines democracy itself. Now, populism has a long history, and so is polarization. But now polarization has been amplified by post-truth, by social media and all the new technologies of information. That we see how they're shaping politics and business and social mores and everything. So the three together, they have always existed. The post-truth used to be called propaganda, and it was a mostly undertaken by governments, but now everybody can, be a populist from his or her house or office. So the essence of the story is that we have three long-standing old trends that have modern ways and modern manifestations, and they are defining the use and misuse of power nowadays.
If I could, let me see if I can sort of summarize some of what you just said. So liberal democracies, for listeners here in the upper Midwest or people who are going to listen to the podcast later, that's really essentially governments like what the United States has had. It's the governments around the world that became our allies after World War II. There are checks and balances in the governmental system, how we run our countries from a political perspective to make sure that you don't have a concentration of power. So America is a liberal democracy. The United Kingdom is a liberal democracy. Germany, France, etc. are liberal democracies. Is that a good summarization, Dr. Naim?
Excellent. Okay. Excellent, yes.
And then on the populism side, populist movements sort of frame their issues around the noble people, in other words, the working class, say, Americans, being sort of taken advantage of by these political elites or scientists or whoever is that you've identified as the people who are taking away your opportunities in life. Is that also a good way to frame it?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
The polarization piece. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about the polarization that's happening in countries around the world. Frankly, the polarization that's dividing us as a people in say the United Kingdom or France or America or take your pick of amongst the liberal democracies. What is polarization specifically?
Is using deeply held emotions and manipulated deeply held emotions that in turn have been shaped by the realities of people. And essentially deny others that don't think like them to have the right of government, to have the right of politics. In the United States, we have seen the sad, dangerous rays of the white supremacists. They don't recognize others as legitimate, players. Mm-hmm. And so they touch deeply held, manifestations of this. Very often they lie openly. But that's a good example where you are essentially looking for wedge issues in society and drill on them and make them even more more profoundly divided. And so, again, divide and conquer. And so what is very scary is that polarization has gone global. Mm-hmm. And you find the same manifestations of a divided country that it makes it very hard to govern, right? If you have a country that is so deeply divided and different actors, different groups, political parties, ideologies, do not recognize others as legitimate players. Very hard to govern. And that is happening around the world, and that is why we're looking at frequency, we see elections that do not solve the problem, but just quantify with precision how divided a society is. And no one gets big landslide votes that then get a mandate to do this or that. It's just precarious, razor-thin advantages that take people to power, and then they are constrained by a lot of factors. But at the same time, they end up doing things stealthily and undermining democracy by weakening the checks and balances.
So we have leaders all around the world who have been democratically elected into the leadership of their country, based on sort of a populist platform, who have then used polarization to further fracture their society in this divide and conquer methodology that you've described. And then the post-truth narratives, which you said is essentially modern forms of propaganda, help reinforce the control that the rising authoritarian or autocratic leader then has. Is that also a good summarization?
Absolutely. And it's both that and at the same time providing new tools to shape politics in a country, using narratives and stories, very, very often not falsehoods, but is what people want and want to listen. And it's the kind of political preferences that increasingly are not sustained in fact.
Can I ask you, so typically, I think in the liberal democracies around the world, we've had a check on governmental power through what's referred to as the Fourth Estate or the free media, the free press, professional journalists who have done a fine job of holding to account political leaders who would have gotten away with these things or would have tried these things in the past but couldn't get away from them. Can you talk a little bit about the sort of maybe the lack of success that traditional journalism has had in holding these populist leaders to account or holding, you know, checks and balances in the system through the free press? Is that an issue that you see is happening on a global scale?
And it's critically important. The answer is yes, of course. It's critically important, still misunderstood, and parts that we understand we don't have the policies to deal with them. As I mentioned, 10 years ago, I wrote a book called The End of Power. The end of power did not relate only to governments, but I saw it and I documented how it was happening in the private sector, in the military, in non-governmental organizations, in churches, in sports clubs, and of course, the media. And as you well described, John, the traditional journalism, traditional media, the way it was performed in the past is no longer there. Now we have a proliferation of channels, vehicles, instruments, technologies that allow even an individual to have adopt roles that in the past were concentrated in traditional outlets, magazines and newspapers and newscasts and all of that. This has a good part to it, in which, you know, it's more democratic, it's more, you know, everybody has access and can share with the world his or her opinions, but it's also very confusing. It is being used very often to manipulate, distort, and eventually harm some of the people that believe in these ideas. You asked me what was my current line of work, and I mentioned the intersection of politics and economics, but I am also very interested in understanding the behavior of people that believe in the most easy to confirm and verify as lies. Mm. And so how gullible we all have become. And just, you know, it would just take a couple of more clicks when we get a message that is deeply polarizing, disseminating hate, and it would just take a couple of clicks in your computer to find out, you know, what are the foundations of that lie. And yet people are attached to these ideas that have a very deep emotional connection to their realities, to their lives, that they believe that they believe in these things. And I am very interested in understanding the behavior of these people.
So your book, The Revenge of Power, you study these issues on a global scale, and one of the things that you highlight in the book is that oftentimes the people who are willing to follow these democratic leaders who run on sort of a populist approach is that they've often been left behind in the modernized global economy. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, but it depends. It's a broad perspective, which is correct. There is a sense inequality has become a very important issue. Inequality has always existed. It reached, it became even more intense in the last decade or so. The global financial crisis that we all lived in 2008, 2009, 10, deepened inequality and the feelings of injustice and how the burdens were not being carried equally by everybody, but the wealthy were essentially inoculated from the travails of global politics and economics. Yes, that's a story that is going to be with us for a while. People that have these grievances are correct very often, and the governments have failed to provide the kinds of answers, policies, and institutions to help them and support them and ensure that the working class, the middle class, is not hurt inordinately by the frequent financial shocks that the global economy and the local economies are suffering.
And that actually was echoed by, I'm sure you know, Dr. Fiona Hill. Her book, There's Nothing For You Here, talked about those as case studies in the UK, the mining towns, the coal mining towns in the UK, and then areas here across the United States where people were sort of left behind economically as the economy fundamentally changed around them. And, you know, their resentment, essentially the politics of resentment, which you talk about in your book as well, are part of what these leaders tap into in their rise to power. Some of what you discuss is that there are certain traits that people have where they are somewhat receptive to the message from an authoritarian type leader, and that this modern look that we have with leaders who tap into the three P's, populism, polarization, and post-truth, is that they've become almost like rock star political leaders rather than servants of the people. Could you comment on those items?
Yeah, that's a fascinating subject because it has to do with the adoption of techniques that became very important and were always part of the arts, and we have a word for that, fandom. We are fans of sports clubs or artists or, fandom. It's an attachment that goes beyond being a follower, that goes beyond liking the soccer, you know, player or the baseball player or the artist. It goes to the identity. The person intertwines his or her identity and includes the fact that they are connected to this superstar. Well, the politicians adopted that. Charisma, which is the ability to attract others and get supporters, has always been there in politics. Adolf Hitler was a monster, but was very charismatic, and he managed to manipulate and to the German people in amazing ways. And so, you know, fandom it goes beyond what we had seen in the past, and is the intense using the technologies of post-truth and social media and everything else that we know. It's creating these kinds of relationship in which followers are beyond followers. They are their own. Who they are is also defined by who they follow and support.
And that's another point that you bring out. Dr. Naeem, we're going to take a very short break for just about a minute as we identify our sponsor, the Cybersecurity Summit. We'll be right back.
National Security This Week is sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. The Cybersecurity Summit brings together cyber experts from industry, academia, and all levels of government to explore challenges, solutions, and opportunities in the cyber arena. The three-day summit includes speakers, workshops, discussions about advancing a cyber career, and keynote addresses by top leaders from across the cyber community. Learn more at cybersecuritysummit.org.
And we're back with Dr. Moises Naeem. Dr. Naeem, I suspect it would aid people's understanding of how these political forces are at play by discussing a few case studies. In your book, you go into great depth in The Revenge of Power, talking about some of these really interesting movements that vaulted some of these charismatic leaders to power through democratic processes, and then they consolidated that power to sort of establish themselves as autocrats. Hugo Chavez comes to mind, Viktor Orban, there are others. Could you choose three or four examples from your book that you think most effectively outline how these three P's that autocrats use to secure their hold on political leadership?
Sure, and and I would pick three very different individuals in different countries that somehow managed to have very similar politics and policies. One is Silvio Berlusconi in Italy, who was prime minister in the 90s and stayed and is now still part of his party, is part of the coalition that is ruling Italy. That he's one. The other is Donald Trump. And the third is Hugo Chavez, who was elected in, he's a military guy that was attempted a coup, failed, went to jail, was pardoned, and then ran and won an election. What do they have in common? The three of them, Hugo Chavez, Donald Trump, and Berlusconi. Well, the demonization of the past, the notion that nothing in the past is worth protecting or using. Everything is nefarious and negative and bad. Is what we call the anti-politics. And it, you know, throw them all out. Bring me new faces, new people, new leaders that have had nothing to do with power or with government or with business and are responsible for this dire situation in which we are. Remember Donald Trump talking about the carnage. In America. So the three, even though the three of them are extremely different, you cannot imagine more different individuals in their background, in the outlook, in their behaviors and so on. But they then you read what they say and it's almost impossible to differentiate one from the other. They all say, the three of them say the same thing, even though their nations, their politics, their economics, their international relations, their society, their values are very, very, very different. And yet they end up behaving exactly the same way.
And all three of them reject what we would refer to as quote-unquote experts. People have actually studied these different issues in public policy for decades in some cases and really know what they speak. But these political leaders have rejected experts in favor of they know best. They know what the people need or want. Is that a fair assessment?
It's absolutely, these kinds of autocrats don't like data, don't like evidence, don't like journalists that probe too much, don't like scientists, don't like experts. There is a famous story about Michael Rove, who was a minister in England, in the United Kingdom, when they were debating Brexit, which was the divorcing from Europe. You know, the United Kingdom was going to sever, was not going to be a longer part of the project of uniting Europe. And his party and the Michael Rove's party was there promoting that. And actually, they won an election largely based on offering that. And there was a study made by some of the most respected analysts about what would the consequences be of this Brexit, of exiting Britain, exiting the links with Europe. And it was catastrophic. It was bad. And so Michael Rove was asked about this and said, you know, the British people are tired of experts. We don't need experts anymore. and now sadly, one has to lament the fact that yes, they won the election. They imposed Brexit and a lot of the costs and calamities that was predicted in the study, the expert that he disdained are taking place, are happening.
So you highlighted Silvio Berlusconi, Hugo Chavez, and Donald Trump. Are there other countries that you can look at, or that you looked at in your book, your research, where the rise of these individuals was somewhat similar?
Absolutely. Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines. You mentioned Viktor Orban in Hungary. And so on. Let me share with you an experience that it may be of interest to your listeners. I have been discussing the book, The End of Power, now for the book came out in February, just 2 days before Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Mm. The book was not written with that in mind, except that Putin is and what his behavior is perfect. He's a 3P president without any doubt. You know, he is a master user of populism, polarization, and post-truth. And so I discuss the book in Indonesia, in Malaysia, in Spain, in Israel, in Italy, in Colombia, in throughout Latin America. And inevitably, in our conversation, someone asks, why have you used our country as a model for the rest of the world? And I said, well, I did not, join the line of those who believe that the book is based on one country. And no, the book highlights how in even extremely different nations, societies, you end up with similar behaviors embodied by the three Ps.
And could you maybe for help our listeners understand, you document really well how Silvio Berlusconi came to power and Hugo Chavez. Now, those two nations are very familiar to American audience. Could you maybe talk a little bit about how each of them used this process to rise to power and then hold on to power for as long as they did?
Well, in the case of Donald Trump, he was not able to win the election and stay in power. So, you know, he is a very good example of, power in the 21st century, easy to acquire, harder to use, and easier to lose. You know, mm-hmm. Donald Trump is a perfect confirmation of that perspective.
Yeah.
In the case of Berlusconi, populism, you know, he was an early adopter and an intense user of populism in a country that has a long history of that. Mussolini was also a master manipulator of public opinion, and again concentrating power and having retained, you know, the story here is one of retaining all of the manifestations of democracy, but in fact behind that there is not a democracy. They, for example, take over the courts and put their loyalists that do not act objectively, but act at the service of the executive, of the presidency, the prime minister. The media, they stifle the media no longer with brutal censorship, even though there's still a lot of that. But essentially, by buying out the networks, buying out the newspapers, buying out and just immediately changing the editorial approach to make it subservient to the power, the center. So there's a whole and the book presents the list of the stealthy maneuvers that are not visible to the naked eye of normal people, but that are used to concentrate power and to undermine democracy.
Even in your introduction in your book, you talk about some of the scholarly work by people like Tim Snyder, Anne Applebaum, and others, where they talk about these patterns that you're discussing right now. Criminalization of political rivals, using external threats to highlight the threat to, you know, the noble people in the populist movement, militarization and paramilitarization, crumbling national borders, denigrating of experts, attacking the media, undermining checks and balances, and then the what we talked about a little while ago, the fandom factor, tapping into the charisma of particular leaders. All of your case studies, all of the things you discuss in this book, all these leaders around the world have tapped into all of these things in their rise to power. Maybe could you talk a little bit about Viktor Orban's rise to power in Hungary?
Well, it was all similar to that of Berlusconi in Italy, except that Orban went one step beyond and he's able to retain power just by with tricks. He has elections, but are not real, transparent and elections. He controls the media, not by censorship, but he essentially suddenly a bunch of quote-unquote investors went and bought radio stations and newspapers, local newspapers. So if you live in Hungary today, you have a hard time having access to information. That is not provided by the government. Exactly the same, or perhaps even worse. Even worse is happening in Russia. It's happening in Venezuela under Maduro, who is Nicolas Maduro, is the successor, the autocrat that succeeded Hugo Chavez in power. Hugo Chavez died of cancer in 2013. It's quite striking how you go around and, the similarities are uncanny.
And can you talk a little bit about how, and you talk about this really well in the book, how big tech globally, I mean, big tech reaches the across the globe today. All of these major tech companies have tremendous ability to influence politics and economics and perspectives that people have. Are these leaders, these 3P autocratic leaders, are they tapping into the power of these big tech companies like Twitter and Facebook and everything else to expand their appeal to the people, to their supporters?
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is no longer a hypothesis. I think we have evidence, quite significant evidence. In fact, we also have evidence of other nations interfering in the politics and elections of another, notably the Putin's Russia and the United States. 17 intelligence agencies of the United States agreed and signed a document explicitly stating and denouncing that the Russian agents and Russia's players in the social media affected, participated, and influenced elections in the United States and around the world. So yes, this is something that is with us. The big tech companies are going through their own transitions. What's happening today in Twitter? There's a huge fight over how to conduct Twitter. Is it a platform for politics for by anyone under any circumstances, or is something else? There is, I think that the conflicts around Twitter and what's happening and what should happen are going to be very illustrative of the kind of trends that the world is going to follow. I hope that there are important lessons being learned and applied to guarantee and ensure that post-truth doesn't become an entrenched, irreparable damage to our public discourse and politics.
And I'd like to ask a couple of follow-up questions on that point. So the power that the tech companies have to reach audiences on a global scale, you mentioned about the U.S. intelligence community clearly identifying that Russia tried to influence the 2016 presidential election here in the United States. But it's not just the U.S. where Russia and other intelligence services from other countries have tried to influence public opinion, sway elections. The Russians have been doing that in elections across Europe in an effort to sort of divide the European Union or NATO amongst the people in those member countries. I'm a retired intelligence officer. I know a little bit about how things work. Influence operations are a form of covert action that are facilitated through these modern-day tech companies. Is that part of post-truth, this propaganda capability?
Absolutely. In the past, as I already mentioned, in the past, propaganda was mostly the tool of governments and organizations. Now is everybody can engage in his or her own propaganda operation. Yes, the technology has created wonderful opportunities to promote freedom, but also dangerous opportunities to sow discord, confusion, and chaos.
And you highlight in one piece here, a former editor of the British newspaper The Guardian, Alan Rusbridger, said, "A society that cannot agree on a factual basis for discussion or decision-making cannot progress. There can be no laws, no votes, no government, no science, no democracy without a shared understanding of what is true and what is not." Can you comment on that a little bit, the impact that that's having on our societies around the world?
My main comment when I hear you say that, which I used citing Alan, is that I am still believe, I've been doing this now for a while, but I'm still bewildered by that statement, because it's true. It is so obvious that unless we get our act together in terms of how to use the new technologies and how to, have the politics for the 21st century that includes the limits, the capacity of bad actors to manipulate voters and individuals, we are in dire straits. It is a priority that people understand that their democracy is important, is valuable, is worth defending. And it takes more than going every 4 years to vote I'm not suggesting that everyone has to become an activist and devote, you know, half their lives to politics. I'm not at all. But I do believe that just thinking that democracy is perhaps going to vote once every 4 years is a very dangerous path. Or that believing anything that aligns with your sentiments, but is not true, but then you start promoting that, is also a very complicated thing. As I said, my campaign is please click twice. when you hear something or you read something that it seems outrageous, don't believe it before clicking a couple of times more to understand where is this coming from, how legitimate, objective, credible is the organization that or the individual that is putting out this information.
So for our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Moises Naim, and we're discussing global challenges to democracy. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. You can learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. Dr. Naim, we have about 14 minutes left in our show today. It's amazing to me how quickly the hour goes by every Wednesday morning. You've outlined for us some very concerning trends regarding the challenge to democracy around the world. American leadership has traditionally stood against these kinds of challenges. Throughout the Cold War, that was true. But our nation is now over $30 trillion in debt. We have strategic security challenges with the People's Republic of China, and certainly with Russia, Iran, North Korea, and many others, places where autocracy has really taken hold. As someone who's studied these challenges to liberal democracies around the world, what should American policymakers do to strengthen our allies and our friends' resilience against these insidious forces of populism, polarization, and post-truth tactics used by autocratic political leaders or parties? How do we inoculate ourselves against these forces?
By working together. And we are, and that sounds lame and not interesting, but it is, we are living in an age where our problems are global in nature. They have always been, but never as now, as intense, as important, wide-ranging. So globalization, the integration of the world's economies, societies, cultures, politics, is happening. And so the more the world integrates, and the more the phrase, you know, what happens there matters here, and vice versa. What happens in Wuhan, China, with the pandemic, with COVID, mattered in the world in a matter of 72 hours, it was already in Europe, and then immediately following a strange trajectory and at very high speed, the virus was everywhere. So that's a very good example of globalization and how what happens there matters here, vice versa. So that creates what I call the most dangerous deficit in the world, which is not an economic deficit, but an institutional deficit. As the world integrates, the problems become global in nature, meaning that no country acting alone can solve them. It requires coalitions, it requires alliances, it requires multilateral operation, which is a horrible word, but it's countries working together, which is very hard, very unstable, and very difficult. But if many of the problems, if not the real problems that are facing humanity, have that characteristics. They need countries to work together. The pandemic was an example. Climate change is a supreme example of what we need to do together. And the challenges that will come with the wide adoption of artificial intelligence. I can go on with a long list of problems that are true challenges to the survival of humanity that require urgent alliances, urgent, effective, stable, powerful, influential alliances, meaning countries working together. I'm not suggesting that every important decision has to be approved by the 190-something nations represented in the UN, the United Nations. But I'm saying that, you know, in each problem, there are about 20 countries that will account for more than half of the problem and more than half of the solution. So let's start talking about minilateralism. Instead of 190 something countries, let's work with the 20 that create the are part of the problem and have to be part of the solution. So that's the story. It's a story of alliances are always cumbersome, unwieldy, ineffective, boring, bureaucratic, but we need them.
So if I could, because you're a perfect person to comment on this, one of the things I've sort of noted over time is that when you have these populist leaders that get elected, a lot of times they turn to sort of nationalist themes to maintain power, to hold power. And a lot of what happens when you have a nationalist government in power is they reject these multilateral approaches. They reject free trade agreements. They reject alliances with other countries. So it is to the autocrats' benefit to push those kinds of narratives that nationalism is the way to go, because it basically winds up isolating the countries that adopt a nationalist approach. Do you see these dangers taking place around the world today, where nationalism has taken root in these governments that are controlled by these 3P autocrats?
Absolutely. They're everywhere. They have always been there. Nationalism is a very powerful force, which oddly enough in the United States is not recognized as such. The United States is a nationalistic country. Nationalism rise high in the United States and has yielded, mistakes in American foreign policy have been done by underestimating the importance of nationalism in other countries. For the United States is the promotion of democracy, for some other countries is the invasion by a superpower. A lot of what was happening in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and somewhere, even Vietnam, nationalism of the United States played a very important role. But that's very hard to recognize. And we see in Washington continuous policies that ignore that other countries are highly nationalistic. So a country that, like the United States, which is nationalist, and there are very positive, good things about that, but cannot appraise and act accordingly, that other countries are also nationalists. And taking that into account would perhaps avoid problems.
Yeah. So, Dr. Moises Naim, you've served in government in Venezuela in the early 90s. You've studied government and foreign policy throughout your career, as well as economics and related topics. What countries in the world today most concern you with regard to these forces of populism, polarization, and post-truth narratives, and why?
First and foremost, the United States. I think democracy is an endangered species. There's a high risk of disappearance. Only 21 nations today can be classified as full democracies. 21 out of 190 something. So the United States is important. The United States, because what will happen to democracy in the United States, and how it is practiced, how it is operated, how it works, matters to other countries and defines how other countries use democracy. The United States is better off, and Americans are better off, when in other countries democracy reigns. Because when there is no democracy, the probabilities of conflicts are higher, both domestic, internal conflict, and international conflict. So it is a national interest of the United States to ensure that most countries, as many as possible, are functioning democracies and not stealthy autocrats. That doesn't mean that you don't have to sit down and do business with the likes of Saudi Arabia, for example, or others, even China, that are clearly not democracies. But that's the story. It is very important to strengthen democracy in the United States in order to be able to be more effective creating conditions there in other places. Again, I'm not suggesting that the United States starts exporting democracy. Democracies have to come from the country, from the each individual in a specific country cannot, it's not an exportable good, democracy. But there are things that the United States can do to help facilitate democracy, the ascent and the strength of democracies elsewhere.
Are there maybe one or two other countries around the world that have been subjected to the rise of these 3P autocrats that are of particular concern to you?
Well, we have, as we speak, in the country of Peru, there is quite a mess in terms of the president that was clearly in unable to fulfill his office. And people are in the streets, the country is divided, and so that, there is a lot going on there. That's one. Of course, one wants to see what happens in Ukraine as the fighting abates. What form will government take? Will democracy thrive in Ukraine as a result of this war? Or not? And so those are two examples, very different, Peru and Ukraine, but amazingly similar in terms of the kinds of 3Ps that are present there.
And Dr. Naim, we only have about 4 minutes left, but I always like to try and give my guest the last word. What else should our listeners know about this topic? What didn't I ask you today that I should have asked you?
It's important to strengthen democracy in the United States, and that will not happen without the active participation or more active participation of the people. I already said it, but it's worth reminding and stressing again. Democracy is not voting every 4 years only. You need to be better informed. You have to have a curiosity and interest about what's happening, and understand that what's happening in politics will affect you and your family in very direct ways. And you cannot delegate or ignore that. So the appeal to be better informed, and as I said, I am very aware that people are busy raising children and making a living, and nobody has time for this. But find the time to just understand a little bit more of what's going on and the kinds of things we are talking. And then the book, as you know, The Revenge of Power, talks about the politically homeless class. The hundreds of millions of Americans and others around the world that don't have an ideology that they can embrace. In the United States, the number of independents is raising at great speed. People that are homeless, they don't have a political home that represents their interests, their ideas, their values, their realities. And we need to understand that. And I hope that new political homes will provide shelter and guidance and union to the politically homeless millions that are now in the United States.
One final question, Dr. Naim, before we close out the show today. Actually, two. Where can our listeners find your latest book, The Revenge of Power?
In bookstores, wherever books are sold, online and digitally, or in paper. In bookstores, I think it's everywhere. And the digital, there's a digital version, there's an audio version, there is... and it's in different countries. The book is out in 14 different languages.
Oof, that's impressive. And you have published many scholarly articles on a wide range of topics. Do you have a website where people can access more of your work?
Indeed, moisesnaim.com. One word, moisesnaimtogether.com.
Dr. Moises Naim, this has been a wonderful discussion. Thank you for sharing your knowledge with us today. Have a wonderful upcoming holiday season.
Thank you. Thank you, John. It was a wonderful conversation. I'm very grateful for the invitation. All the best.
Folks, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. I look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Colonel Matt Sousa, and we'll discuss economics, politics, and security across southern Africa. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week. Have a great finish to your week, everyone. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns with host John Olson. It's brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check their website, cybersecuritysummit.org, for a listing of their upcoming webinar series.